Well, hey, we're back. This is the next episode of The Break Breakdown. I'm your host, Courtney Romano. And today, I'm talking about, it's just me on this episode, and I'm kind of picturing this like, we're not out of quarantine yet when I'm recording this. It's late March, but I'm pretending that you and I, whoever you are, my friend, are at a bar in the West Village, and it's raining out, and we're having a beer, and I gotta look up the place that I'm thinking of, but it's like near Bleecker, and it's like really old and wooden, like everything feels like it could go up in flames at any second, and there's like peanuts on the floor, stuff like that. That's where I imagine we're having this conversation, because this is like talking shop. And I don't want to scare anyone away by saying like, let's talk shop in this, because I know in the past few episodes in this season, we've covered a lot of broad topics, and then we kind of zero in on things, and we go broad, and we zero in. And this is definitely a zeroing in kind of episode, because I'm going to be talking about the writing concept, three uses of the knife, and what that means, and how to apply it, and why it makes really good storytelling. But I don't want you to get thrown off by the fact that that's what I'm doing, because it's actually, I think, a technique that everyone can use in their storytelling to make their storytelling better, even just like, you know, how is your day, dear? Like those stories that we tell over and over and over again. And I also think that, well, here's a quote from my therapist, okay, direct to you, free of charge. She told me that therapy was telling the same story over and over and over again until we don't, right? And I think that what she was getting at with that, or at least what I took from it in that, was that we tell the stories we need to tell until we've got them, until we get it, until it sinks in, until we've made sense of it, and then we can just release it and move on to a next story that we've got to tell again and again and again. But there does feel, to me, like there's a sense of progress, or at least a sense of fullness and coming into my wholeness every time I wrap a story, like a story that I've been telling myself in my own mind. So this isn't therapy. I just set it up to be like therapy. It's not therapy, and it's not a solve for anything. But all I'm trying to say is we're going to go into some brass tacks of storytelling and writing based on this concept that David Mamet talks about a lot and wrote a book on. And I think it's still applicable when you think about the way that you've told stories in your own life and how they've evolved over time and how you can use them just within yourself to feel more whole and more like yourself, which, to be fair, is what I think art is meant to help us do anyway. So just like, let's be ourselves and get into it. Okay, so what's the rule? This rule that I'm talking about, this writing rule, this rule of drama that I'm talking about is called three uses of the knife. And David Mamet talks about it in his book titled Three Uses of the Knife. And he talks about it in his masterclass, and it's not a concept he came up with. But I wanted to talk about it today because March was a very difficult month. In our household, there was a lot of stuff being kind of dredged up from the winter, and everything's okay, but it was just hard. And a lot of times as artists, I feel like, at least for me, when I get really in the weeds of my life and my personal stuff, which has been essentially all of 2020 and into 2021 so far, it's really hard for me to focus on creative work. I know we're supposed to be like struggling, starving artists who are just always desperate, and that's supposed to be like romanticized or whatever, but I actually need to like wake up early and have a good breakfast and work out, and like I need things to be in order. I don't need things to be in order to write, but damn, it's really helpful if they are, unless I'm writing about the thing that is tearing me apart inside, in which case, yeah, there are no rules. But my point being, when I have a lot going on in my head beyond the art that I'm trying to make, it's really difficult to make edits. And it's really difficult to not even make edits, but be like, wait, what do I need to do next? What do I need to figure out next about this piece? And that was happening with the thing that I'm writing right now, and which is a limited series. So it's 8 episodes. And I didn't really know what I wanted to work on next. So I was like, well, let me just be a student for a second. And I watched all these master classes and I was reading all these books. And this concept that I learned, Three Uses of the Knife, just really spoke to me. And so I wanted to share it with you because I feel like when we focus on specifics and get obsessed with one detail, it opens up all these doors for us in our writing or our creation or our life. And so I feel like if it worked for me, it might work for you. So I want to share with you. So in this episode, I'm going to break down A, number one, what that rule is. What is Three Uses of the Knife? 2, how it helps you write better, you know, whether you're writing drama or not, like how it helps you write better and how it actually functions. And then 3, a really quick case study of how I can apply Three Uses of the Knife to my film Screen Test, which is just a short film, a 14-minute film. It's always linked in the show notes if you ever want to go watch it. And I didn't know about this concept when I wrote it. I think it's an internalized concept that maybe you will already know in and of yourself, just from telling stories, reading stories, watching stories, all of that. But I wasn't aware of it as much when I wrote Screen Test and when we filmed it. But it still applied, and it was actually a really great exercise for me to go back and see how and if it applied. So I do highly recommend, if you've written anything, to listen to this full episode and then go back to your writing or if you haven't written anything, your favorite movie, and see if you can apply this and see where it applies. And then in May, when everyone's vaccinated, we can meet at that bar in the West Village and talk about it. What is the rule? Three Uses of the Knife. So in his masterclass and in this book, David Mamet talks about this quote that was basically the underpinning for his entire philosophy here. The quote is from Huddy Ledbetter, who was known as Lead Belly Ledbetter, who was an American blues singer and musician. And he was talking, and Lead Belly was talking about the verses in a blues song. And he said, in the first verse, you take a knife and you use it to cut the bread so that you'll have strength to work. In the second verse, you use the knife to shave so you'll look nice for your lover. And in the third verse, on discovering her with another lover, you use it to cut out her lying heart. Okay, so that's like a little much for 2021, but the concept is really fascinating to me. So you take the knife to cut the bread, then you use that same knife to shave, then you use that same knife to enact revenge, whatever. And I heard, that's the concept. Okay, so I've heard actually Shonda Rhimes talk about this too, where she was talking about how she used alcohol for Olivia Pope in Scandal and how she used the alcohol in different ways to basically show the change and show the inner life in Olivia Pope without having to say it out loud, and what those different kinds of drinks would represent and when she was drinking and how she was drinking. And those little details are how you show instead of tell. And of course, if you're writing for film, the whole thing is show, don't tell. So when you can find those physical manifestations of showing and not telling, they're really, really helpful. And another kind of way into thinking about this, Three Uses of the Knife, I was thinking about something a professor told me in college. So we were doing, I was a theater and dance major in college, and for the dance major, I don't know if it was actually for the dance major, if this was like extracurricular, but we were making pieces. We were making dance. I was choreographing. And we would come into the dance studio at, you know, some point during the semester before the concert, the dance concert, and we'd all sit down and we'd have a showing and we would give each other notes and feedback and what I'm getting from this and I'm wondering about that and all of that stuff. All of that stuff that you have time and resources to do in college. That's like my dream, is that after we go to this amazing bar in the West Village, we also then like can go to this beautiful rehearsal space and just like give each other notes. That's like my version of a great date, and probably actually how Craig and I spend most of our time together is giving each other notes. Okay, I'm getting off track, so I'm coming back to it. So in dance, let me set you up a little bit. So in dance, there are things called phrases in choreography. You create a phrase of movement. It might be, it's kind of like a paragraph in writing. You know, it's an idea, a concept, a phrase. You know when it begins and you know when it ends. It's just a feeling of like, you get it. And so the feedback that I got once was my professor telling me at one of these showings that if you're going to repeat a phrase in the dance, in the entire piece, then give me new information every time that phrase comes up. So maybe that means, you know, the movement phrase is one person doing something in the middle of the stage, and then the second time the phrase comes up in the piece, there's two people doing it. Or, you know, maybe it's a group of people doing it, but the second time it comes up, half of them are doing it retrograde, which means doing the movement backwards in time. Or maybe it's a phrase that you use to open the piece. It starts the piece. It's this beautiful thing in the beginning of the piece. You never visit that movement phrase again, or that movement vocabulary again. And then this whole dance happens, and then at the very end of the piece, you repeat it. And it's the exact same thing, but the reason that it's different is because you've just experienced this whole dance piece, and the audience experiences this whole dance piece, and then they get to experience this phrase again. So it's different and it's new. So that came up for me while I was kind of studying this concept, because the idea of the three uses of the knife is that the knife changes. And the knife doesn't just change. Like it becomes more itself. Like it becomes more refined as a tool, right? I mean, in the Lead Belly quote, it's basically saying like, this knife could kill you, right? And that's true. And we know that's true. It can also cut bread. It can also help you shave. It has all of these things. But at the end of this day, this knife could kill you. And so the last thing that you end on is new information, but it's the most truthful of the information, or maybe not even the most truthful, but the most pure and distilled. And that is how the plot and the devices used in the plot of your writing, of our writing, have to move, right? It has to be like, we start with this idea that's one piece of information, and then things happen within the plot of the story that you're telling to give you new information. And at the end of the story you're telling, something is going to have changed, like chemically in us when we see this device show up again for a third time. There's new information. It means something different to us now. Okay, so I'm going to give you examples of this because it's kind of a heady concept to talk about. But then when you apply it, it's really simple to see, like extremely obvious, to the point where you're probably already doing it in whatever you're writing, but it might be helpful to just have words to it and a concept to put to it, because you'll be like, oh yeah, of course, that's a natural tendency, but now I can actually intentionally go after that. So I'm going to give you some concrete examples from Screen Test. Again, if you want to watch it before you listen to this, the link is in the show notes, and you could just probably Google Screen Test, or if you go to Vimeo and look up Screen Test, it's on Vimeo for free. Or if you don't care about the spoilers, just listen to it later and see watch it later and see if I'm right or wrong. But I'm going to give you that just as a concrete example that we can work from, because I think it's pretty helpful. Before we get into the breakdown of basically a case study of screen test and how the three uses of the knife were used in screen test. I want to quickly talk about how this concept helps us write better. So another thing that Mamet says in the book, and probably in his book True and False, which I also read, and probably every book he's ever written, is, here's a quote, "The subject of drama is the lie." That's with a capital L, by the way. So the subject of drama is the lie. At the end of the drama, the truth, which has been overlooked, disregarded, scorned, and denied, prevails. And that is how we know the drama is done. So basically, it's like when we finally get to the end of a plot and a piece of dramatic writing, we feel like it makes sense. Like, we don't have to be happy about it, but we're like, yes, I accept this. And I was trying to think of something that happened in my life that kind of illustrated this. And I was like, oh yes, of course, my birthing experience, my labor with my child. And I'm going to tell you a story about that. But the reason that I want to tell you that story is that I think it's really important as a writer and a creator and a teller of stories to understand that as we're writing these stories, like, we don't always know what the truth is. Sometimes we have to write our way to the truth. Sometimes we start with a concept and we're like, I didn't know what this was until, you know, the letter before I wrote the word before I wrote the final sentence. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like artists and writers start out being like, I have the truth in my hands and I will now distribute it to all my friends. No. It's like literally we're as lost as everyone else, but we're just using words to figure out like our way out of the dark. Like, that's it. It's nothing special. It's just the way we do it. So I feel like there's this concept that sometimes writers try to put on themselves about teaching a lesson. And I personally believe we're not here to teach each other lessons, but we're here to help witness each other so that we can each internally on our own go through the hero's journey and learn our own lessons. I think that we are not meant to tell people what to do or tell people anything prescriptive for them as artists and as writers, but we are here to say as much of the truth as possible, as consistently as possible, as beautifully as possible. Like, that's it. So this concept of three uses of the knife, I think, is actually a really great way to make writing better, make storytelling better, make it more beautiful, and make it more truthful. And so I wanted to tell you this story about when I realized in my labor that I was going to have this emergency C-section. It won't be gory. I promise you it's going to be fine. So my entire labor was about 26 hours. And we started, like, there was, I mean, I won't go into all the details because it's going to bore anyone who's not a mom, probably. Like, when did you get the Pitocin? Like, how long were you in the triage? But it was a long time. There was a lot going on. There was a lot not going on. And we finally got to the point where at the end of this, at the home stretch here at hour 23 or so, where they're like, okay, it's finally time to push. So I pushed for 3 hours. I'll spare you the details there. But let's just say it was not working. Then they had to do an intervention called a vacuum twice. That also did not work. So as you can imagine, I'm now at hour 25 and a half, I want to say. And they're like, Courtney, we have done everything that we could possibly do. Now, let me give you a little backstory here. I am a woman in my 30s, in the culture of America. So I've internalized that everything is my fault, and I have internalized the perfectionism of white supremacy. And so all this to say, I had a lot of hopes wrapped up in delivering through the vaginal canal. Like, that is what I wanted to do. That's what I expected of myself, being a dancer and having been a fitness instructor, and feeling like, I don't know why I thought either of those things made any difference. They don't. That those are just more given circumstances. But I had a lot wrapped up in that. I had also been exhausted. I had been so close very many times, and it just, because of like complications, and thank God, you know, in the end, thank God we didn't, because it was safer to do what we did. But because of complications, I'd get very close to like delivering her, and it just couldn't happen. So there comes a moment in that room, in that labor room, where they're like, we've done literally everything we can, and it's time to, we have to do an emergency C-section. We have to do this now. And they basically were like, okay. Like, they said to me basically like, okay. And they were waiting for me to be like, okay, so they could go. And it was this moment in between them saying okay and me affirming okay that I completely let go. I felt myself letting go. I felt myself being like, this isn't what I want. I am not in control. They're about to do something to me where I will really not be in control. I can't believe this is the way it's happening. This is what's happening. Okay. And I told them okay, and they wheeled me into the operating room, and I was weeping. And you know that release, like, everyone experiences it differently in their body, but when you basically accept something, and you either, like, sometimes the release comes in a laugh, like a guttural belly laugh, and sometimes the release comes in like a scream, and sometimes it comes in tears. Well, mine basically always comes in tears. So I said okay, and they were like, okay, let's go. And, you know, whatever, chaos ensued. And as I'm like in the middle of this chaos, laying down, attached to a million things, like drugs pumped into me, just scared, very scared, but also accepting like, this is what's happening. I just was weeping. I was just crying. And as they wheeled me into that room, and then like tried to pull myself together, yada, yada. And also, by the way, have a beautiful child and an amazing, she's an amazing human, and couldn't be more grateful for the way it all went down. That's just to say, that's not how I pictured it or wanted it. And when I could accept the truth of it, I could meet it, right? When we can accept what it is, we can meet it. And this is the like balancing act where we're talking about being artists, right? Because, man, we got to do this work on our own, but we also have to do it within the art. And sometimes it kind of happens simultaneously. Sometimes we need time to process something before we create art from it and everything like that. But the truth, whether it's personal or artistic, is the same. We are just trying to get there. We're just trying to accept the truth. Just accept what is. Just accept what it is without changing it, because we can't change it, right? And this is what makes writing good, is getting the audience to that point where they just accept that. They accept how the story went, and they accept it because they know in their body, in a guttural or visceral reaction, they know it's true. That is how writing gets to be so freaking good. And the exhale that the audience gets isn't, okay, I'm happy with this outcome. That feels good. Okay, great. The exhale they get is, okay, I accept it. Okay. Just okay. Okay. And only from that place of acceptance is actually where I think change could even possibly begin to think of happening. So again, I don't think we go into writing or go into creating art to teach people anything. I think we go in to witness. I think we are, you know, if I was going to be really goofy, I would say we're like journalists of the soul, but I'm not going to be goofy, so I'm not going to say that. But we are just documenting. We're witnessing. We're trying to tell the truth. And I think when audiences and viewers and watchers can see the truth, they can then decide within themselves what they want to do with that. And that is empowering. And that is like, God, what else would we want to do with our lives? Okay, so here's the case study for Screen Test, all right? So again, remember, three uses of the knife. Use it to cut the bread, use it to shave the face, use it to enact revenge. Those are the three uses of the knife. So the knife in the instance of Screen Test is the audience or the voyeur. There are three ways that we use the audience. And I mean this as like there's not an audience in the film. The film is about fitness instructors trying to get on reality TV, okay? And so a lot of the film is interviews and it's a mockumentary. So, I mean, you've all seen a mockumentary style thing, so you get how those work. That's what it is. The audience or the voyeur is the knife in this instance. So the opening of Screen Test has an Instagram story montage. It's all done in Insta stories. It's all like fast, kind of manic Insta stories of all these influencers who are auditioning spliced together. And that is basically making the bread, right? Or cutting the bread. That's the first use of the audience, is the audience who watches these Insta stories. The middle of and the meat of the film are these talking head interviews. And that's the second use of the knife. Now it's beyond just Insta story. It is, I'm sitting in front of a casting setup. I'm telling my story of who I am and why I think I'd be best for this show. The camera's picking up every little thing, even things that maybe I don't want them to see. So we go from this like very curated, like this is who I am on Instagram and my Instagram story, and I can decide when to cut and I edit it and I filter it and I post it and when I post it and what I tag, it's all controlled. Now I'm in this setting where it's not as controlled from my end as the actor. The audience and the casting people have the lights and the camera and the setup, and I go here and I do this and I get interviewed and I don't get to choose what questions I answer. They ask me questions, I have to answer them. So a little bit of my control is being taken away from the audience. And then the third use of the knife is the end when, and here's the spoiler, the casting director actually walks into the frame and adjusts our heroine, Olivia, her hand and adjusts her body to help her take the picture that she wants to take. So, which is a selfie. So at the very end, we haven't seen the casting director at all. We've heard her, and then she walks into the frame. We see her adjust Olivia, she walks out of the frame, and then we're just left with Olivia kind of in this like awkward place, and the film ends. And so that's how it kind of works in that. The audience now, as the casting director, is completely manipulating us as the actor, as Olivia, the hero, and completely controlling us, and what we think is our free will is not our free will. So this is the truth of it, right? We start with an Instagram story where we are in Instagram story world and we are obsessed with how we are projecting outward. But we get to the end and we realize like all of that is managed and all of that is almost fake control. And we get to the end of Screen Test and we realize we are completely subservient to powers that be that are impersonal and beyond us. And in this film, it took the form of a casting director, probably like leftover residue from my acting years and just feeling like the casting directors always held my fate. But that's what we get to at the end. And, you know, you can agree or disagree if you feel like that landed or not in the film. But for me, it was so important for the casting director to walk into the frame because I wanted the illusion to be broken. And that was the third use of the knife for me, of the audience, to to break that illusion, to break that trance. Okay, so a really quick way to start using this in your own work is to go into anything that you've written. You know, okay, so let's say you've already written something, okay? Go back into it and read it and think about it and ask yourself, what is the device that is propelling this story? And sometimes it's physical, right? Like talking about Shonda Rhimes and Olivia Pope and the alcohol. And sometimes it's a point of view, like in Screen Test, it's the point of view of the audience in those three different points of view. But what is the device that's propelling the story? Now, if it's difficult to answer that question, then my guess is, based on edits and rewrites that I've done, that it's a difficulty with intentions and obstacles. And if there are clear intentions and obstacles, and your protagonist knows what they want and also knows what they're not getting, then you're going to understand the device that is propelling the story along, because it's all wrapped up in intention and obstacle, right? If your intention and your obstacle, especially if you're your main character, is not crystal clear, and I mean like crystal clear, then it might be a little bit harder to decipher what the device is that you could be using for this concept. But you know, it's also a gut check. You'll look at your work and you'll be like, okay, I know what I know, I know. I think when I was looking at Screen Test for a minute, I was like, is it the yoga ball that Jason is always using? It's like, no, that's like a silly thing we did. That's not a device that is compelling the story of Olivia, who's the hero of the story. So look at your hero. What are her intentions? What are her obstacles? What is she not getting? What does she keep trying to get it to get? And how is it just, how does it keep not working out for her until the end, when it either does or it doesn't? In drama, it usually, or in tragedy, it doesn't work out, right? But it could work out in the end, but in tragedy, it usually doesn't. So that's kind of how I would go into working with this at the beginning. Obviously, I want you to tell me everything about it. And obviously, I want you to tell me what you think on Instagram after I just totally trashed it, or write me an email and tell me, or, you know, anything like that. But I want to also leave you with a quote from Mamet, because I just feel like this is a concept that I learned from him and that he learned from Leadbelly Ledbetter. And I just feel like his quote is going to summarize it much more beautifully than I can. So this is a quote from Mamet's book, Three Uses of the Knife. And there are plays and books and songs and poems and dances that are perhaps upsetting or intricate or unusual, that leave you unsure, but which you think about perhaps the next day and perhaps for a week and perhaps for the rest of your life. Because they aren't clean, they aren't neat, but there's something in them that comes from the heart and so goes to the heart. What comes from the head is perceived by the audience, the child, the electorate, as manipulative. And we may succumb to the manipulative for a moment because it makes us feel good to side with the powerful. But finally, we understand we're being manipulated and we resent it. Tragedy is a celebration not of our eventual triumph, but of the truth. It is not a victory, but a resignation. Much of its calmative power comes again from that operation described by Shakespeare. When remedy is exhausted, so is grief. Thank you so much for listening to this In the Weeds, Brass Tacks, Talk and Shop episode of The Break Breakdown. I really hope that talking about this concept of three uses of the knife was useful in the sense of you know, making writing better, making storytelling better, and also just thinking about how we tell stories again and again in our brains alone at night, and how if we can help them evolve, if we can witness them evolve and really truthfully witness them evolve and accept them and behold them and embrace them, that we can get to a point of truth that feels like home. Even if it's not comfortable, it feels like we're home and like we are whole. And then from that, foundation, we can move forward in whatever way is going to be best for us. I hope you liked this episode, and if you did, please take a screenshot of it and share and tag me and Queensbird Films at Queensbird Films on Instagram. That actually, like, legit goes a long way in helping us spread the word about this podcast. We are working on a bunch of new fun things at Queensbird Films this spring, and like everything else in 2020 and 2021, there are some ups and downs and slow starts and hesitations and full speeds ahead and like all kinds of rhythms that we're working in, but we are working on some really cool stuff, and I'm looking forward to sharing that with you in the next few months or so. And yeah, thank you so much for your love and support, and I hope that wherever you are well. I'll talk to you soon.